Chapter 22. Six small fishing boats, painted in a variety of vivid colors, sailed into Rose Harbor, their decks stacked with wooden crates filled with fish packed in ice. The diesel engines made a soft chugging sound through tall exhaust stacks as they turned the shafts to the propellers. A low mist covered the water and turned it a gray-green. The sun was half a globe on the eastern horizon, and the wind was less than 5 knots. The waves showed no white caps, and the only foam came from the prop wash and the bows of the boats as they shouldered their way through gentle swells. Broadmoor came up to Pitt, who was sitting in the stern, watching the gulls that dipped and soared over the boat's wake in hope of a free meal.
"Time to go into your act, Mr. Pitt."
Pitt could never get Broadmoor to call him Dirk. He nodded and pretended to carve a nose on a half-finished mask the Haida had loaned him. He was dressed in yellow oilskin pants with suspenders that were slung over a heavy woolen sweater knitted by Irma Broadmoor. He wore a stocking cap pulled down over his thick black eyebrows. Indians are not known for 5 o'clock shadows, so he had given his face a close shave. He did not look up as he lightly scraped the dull side of the knife over the mask, staring out of the corners of his eyes at the long dock. Not a small pier, but a true landing stage for big ships, with anchored pilings, that loomed larger as the boats entered the harbor. A tall crane moved on rails along one side of the dock to unload heavy equipment and other cargo from ocean-going ships. A large craft with unusually smooth lines and a globular-shaped superstructure, unlike any luxury yacht Pitt had ever seen, lay moored to the dock. Her twin high-performance fiberglass hulls were designed for speed and comfort. She looked capable of skimming the sea at over 80 knots. Going by Giordino's description of a seagoing, space-age design, this was the boat seen running from the freighter Mentawai. Pitt looked for the name and port, normally painted across the transom, but no markings marred the beauty of the yacht's sapphire-blue hull. Most owners are proud of their pet name for their boat, Pitt thought, and its port of registry. He had a pretty good idea why Arthur Dorset didn't advertise his yacht. His interest kindled. He stared openly at the windows with their tightly drawn curtains. The open deck appeared deserted. None of the crew or passengers were about this early in the morning. He was about to turn his attention from the yacht and focus on half a dozen uniformed security guards standing on the dock, when a door opened and a woman stepped out onto the deck. She was incredibly stunning, Amazon tall, strikingly beautiful. Shaking her head, she tossed a long, unbrushed mane of red-blonde hair out of her face. She was wearing a short robe and looked as if she had just risen from bed. Her breasts looked plump, but oddly out of proportion, and were completely covered by the robe that shielded any hint of cleavage. Pitt perceived an untamed, ferocious look about her, as undaunted as a tigress surveying her domain. Her gaze swept over the little fishing fleet, then fell on Pitt when she caught him openly staring at her. The everyday devil-may-care Pitt would have stood up, swept off his stocking cap, and bowed. But he had to play the role of an Indian, so he looked at her expressionless and merely nodded a respectful greeting. She turned away and dismissed him as if he were simply another tree in the forest, while a uniformed steward approached and held out a cup of coffee on a silver tray. Shivering in the cold dawn, she returned inside the main salon.
"She's quite impressive, isn't she?" said Broadmoor, smiling at the look of awe on Pitt's face.
"I have to admit she's unlike any woman I've ever seen."
"Boudicca Dorset, one of Arthur's three daughters. She shows up unexpectedly several times a year on that fancy yacht of hers."
So this was the third sister, Pitt mused. Perlmutter had described her as ruthless and as cold and hard as ice from the bottom of a glacier. Now that he had laid eyes on Dorset's third daughter, Pitt found it hard to believe Maeve had come out of the same womb as Deirdre and Boudicca.
no doubt to demand higher production from her slave laborers and count the take.
Neither, said Broadmoor. Boudicca is director of the company's security organization. I'm told she travels from mine to mine, inspecting the systems and personnel for any weaknesses. Dapper John Merchant will be particularly vigilant while she's probing for cracks in his security precautions, said Pitt.
He'll take special pains to ensure his guards look alert to impress his boss.
We'll have to be extra cautious, Broadmoor agreed.
He nodded toward the security guards on the dock, waiting to inspect the fishing boats.
Look at that. 6 of them. They never sent more than 2 on any other delivery. The one with the medallion around his neck is in charge of the dock. Name is Crutcher. He's a mean one.
Pitt gave the guards a cursory glance to see if he recognized any that had gathered around the float plane during his intrusion with Stokes. The tide was out, and he had to stare up at the men on the dock. He was especially apprehensive about being recognized by the guard he'd laid out in John Merchant's office. Luckily, none looked familiar. They carried their weapons slung over one shoulder, muzzle pointing forward in the general direction of the Indian fishermen. It was all for show and intimidation, Pitt quickly perceived. They weren't about to shoot anyone in front of observing seamen on a nearby cargo ship. Crutcher, a cold-faced, arrogant young man of no more than 26 or 27, stepped up to the edge of the dock as Broadmoor's helmsman eased the fishing boat along the pilings. Broadmoor cast a line that fell over the guard's combat boots.
"Hi there, friend. How about tying us up?"
The cold-faced guard kicked the rope off the dock back onto the boat.
"Tie up yourself," he snapped.
A dropout from a special forces team, that one, Pitt thought as he caught the line. He scrambled up a ladder onto the dock and purposely brushed against Crutcher as he looped the line around a small bollard. Crutcher lashed out with his boot and kicked Pitt upright, then grabbed him by his suspenders and shook him violently.
"You stinking fish head, mind your manners."
Broadmoor froze. It was a trick. The Haida were a quiet people, not prone to quick anger. He thought with fearful certainty that Pitt would shake himself loose and punch the contemptuous guard. But Pitt didn't bite. He relaxed his body, rubbed a hand over a blossoming bruise on his buttocks, and stared at Crutcher with an unfathomable gaze. He pulled off his stocking cap as if in respect, revealing a mass of black hair whose natural curls had been greased straight. He shrugged with a careless show of deference.
"I was not careful, I'm sorry."
"You don't look familiar," said Crutcher coldly.
"I make this trip 20 times," Pitt said quietly. "I've seen you lots before. Your name is Crutcher. 3 deliveries back, you punched my gut for unloading the fish too slow."
The guard studied Pitt for a moment, then gave a short laugh, a jackal laugh. "Get in my way again and I'll boot your ass across the channel." Pitt registered a look of friendly resignation and jumped back onto the deck of the fishing boat. The rest of the fishing fleet was slipping into the openings at the dock between the supply ships. Where there was no room, the boats tied together parallel, end to end, the crew of the outer boat transferring their cargo of fish across the deck of the one moored to the dock. Pitt joined the fishermen and began passing crates of salmon up to one of Broadmoor's crew, who stacked them on flatbed trailers that were hitched to a small tractor vehicle with 8 drive wheels. The crates were heavy, and Pitt's biceps and back soon ached in protest. He gritted his teeth, knowing the guards would suspect he didn't belong if he couldn't heave the ice-filled fish crates around with the ease of the Haida. 2 hours later, the trailers were loaded. Then 4 of the guards and the crews of the fishing boats piled aboard as the train set off toward the mining operations mess hall. They were stopped at the tunnel entrance, herded into a small building, and told to strip to their underwear. Then their clothes were searched, and they were individually x-rayed. All passed scrutiny except one Haida, who absent-mindedly carried a large fishing knife in his boot. Pitt found it strange that instead of merely confiscating the knife, it was returned and the fisherman sent back to his boat. The rest were allowed to dress and reboard the trailers for the journey to the excavation area.
"I would think they'd search you for concealed diamonds when you came out rather than entering," said Pitt.
"They do," explained Broadmoor. "We go through the same procedure when we exit the mine. They X-ray you going in as a warning that it doesn't pay to smuggle out a handful of diamonds by swallowing them."
The arched concrete tunnel that penetrated the mound of mine tailings was about 5 meters high by 10 wide, ample room for large trucks to transport men and equipment back and forth from the loading dock. The length stretched nearly half a kilometer, the interior brightened by long rows of fluorescent lighting. Side tunnels yawned about halfway through, each about half the size of the main artery.
"Where do those lead?" Pitt asked Broadmoor. "Part of the security system. They circle the entire compound and are filled with detection devices." "The guards, the weapons, the array of security systems. Seems like overkill just to prevent a few diamonds from being smuggled off the property."
"Only the half of it. They don't want the illegal laborers escaping to the mainland. It's part of the deal with corrupt Canadian officials."
They emerged at the other end of the tunnel amid the busy activity of the mining operation. The driver of the tractor curled the train of trailers onto a paved road that circled the great open pit that was the volcanic chute. He pulled up beside a loading dock that ran along a low concrete building in the shape of a Quonset hut, and stopped. A man wearing the white attire of a chef under a fur-trimmed overcoat opened a door to a warehouse where foodstuffs were stored. He threw a wave of greeting to Broadmoor.
"Good to see you, Mason. Your arrival is timely. We're down to 2 cases of cod."
"We've brought enough fish to grow scales on your workers."
Broadmoor turned and said in a low voice to Pitt, "Dave Anderson, the head cook for the miners. A decent guy, but he drinks too much beer."
"The frozen food locker is open," said Anderson. "Mind how you stack the crates. I found salmon mixed in with flounder your last trip. It screws up my menus."
"Brought you a treat. 50 kilos of moose steaks."
"You're okay, Mason. You're the reason I don't buy frozen fish from the mainland," the cook replied with a wide smile. "After you've stored the crates, come on into the mess hall. My boys will have breakfast waiting for your people. I'll write a check as soon as I've inventoried your catch."
The wooden crates of fish were stacked in the frozen food locker, and the Haida fisherman, followed by Pitt, thankfully tramped into the warmth of the mess hall. They walked past a serving line and were dished up eggs, sausages, and flapjacks. As they helped themselves to coffee out of a huge urn, Pitt looked around at the men sitting at the other tables. The 4 guards were conversing under a cloud of cigarette smoke near the door. Close to 100 Chinese miners from the early morning graveyard shift filled up most of the room. 10 men, who Pitt guessed to be mining engineers and superintendents, sat at a round table that was set off in a smaller private dining room.
"Which one is your disgruntled employee?" he asked Broadmoor.
Broadmoor nodded toward the door leading into the kitchen.
"He's waiting for you outside by the garbage containers."
Pitt stared at the Indian. "How did you arrange that?"
Broadmoor smiled shrewdly.
"The Haida have ways of communicating that don't require fiber optics."
Pitt did not question him. Now was not the time. Keeping a wary eye on the guards, he casually walked into the kitchen. None of the cooks or dishwashers looked up as he moved between the ovens and sinks through the rear door and dropped down the steps outside. The big metal garbage containers reeked of stale vegetables in the sharp, crisp air. He stood there in the cold, not sure what to expect. A tall figure moved from behind a container and approached him. He was wearing a yellow jumpsuit. The bottoms of the legs were smeared with mud that had a strange bluish cast to it. A miner's hard hat sat on his head, and his face was covered by what Pitt took for a mask with a breathing filter. He clutched a bundle under one arm.
"I understand you're interested in our mining operation," he said quietly. "Yes, my name is..." "Names are unimportant. We don't have much time if you are to leave the island with the fishing fleet."
He unfolded a jumpsuit, a respirator mask, and a hard hat and handed them to Pitt.
"Put these on and follow me."
Pitt said nothing and did as he was told. He did not fear a trap. The security guards could have taken him any time since he set foot on the dock. He dutifully zipped up the front of the jumpsuit, tightened the chin strap of the hard hat, adjusted the respirator mask over his face, and set out after a man he hoped could show him the source behind the violent killings.